Hello, this is UCL Uncovering Politics, and today we're looking at referendums on the constitutional future of Northern Ireland. Could they happen? And if so, how would they best be designed and conducted? Hello, my name is Alan Rennick, and welcome to UCL Uncovering Politics, the podcast of the School of Public Policy and Department of Political Science at University College London. The future of the Union here in the UK, that is the Union of England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, is very much in the news. In Scotland, many opinion polls over the past year, though not so much over the last few months, have suggested majority support for independence, and political parties that want another referendum on the issue secured a majority of seats in the Scottish Parliament elections last month. In Wales, support for independence seems to have grown, though still at a far lower level. And in Northern Ireland too, there has been a rise in talk of a referendum. A referendum that is on whether Northern Ireland should remain part of the United Kingdom or become part of a United Ireland. Well, today we're going to focus on Northern Ireland. If there were a referendum on the constitutional question there, how would it best be designed and conducted? Who would get to vote? What would the question be on the ballot paper? Would there need to be a referendum in the Republic of Ireland as well? Who would work out designs for a United Ireland? Would they do so before a referendum or only afterwards in the event that the vote went in favour of unification? It turns out that many of these questions haven't previously been answered. Indeed, many haven't been thought about very much. A landmark agreement was reached in 1998 between the British and Irish governments and most of the political parties in Northern Ireland, an agreement known variously as either the Belfast Agreement or the Good Friday Agreement. That brought an end to a quarter century of violent conflict in Northern Ireland and led to the creation of the Northern Ireland Assembly and the current arrangements for power-sharing government. It also included some provisions for a possible future referendum, but it left many questions unanswered. Well, now a working group on unification referendums on the island of Ireland has published a major report that seeks to fill that gap. Comprising 12 academics from six universities, including UCL, the group, which is impartial as to whether there should be a referendum or what the outcome should be if there is one, has looked into all the questions I just raised and many more. It finds that referendums on this topic may be required in the coming years, but would carry significant risks. Conducting them well would be vitally important, and careful thought is needed as to what that would mean. So today, we're going to examine the work of this working group. Now, I find myself in a slightly unusual position here because I'm hosting the podcast, as you can tell, but I also chaired the working group. So I'm sitting, if you like, on two sides of the fence. But to help me out, I'm very glad to be joined by three of my fellow working group members. Katie Hayward is Professor of Political Sociology at Queen's University Belfast. She's also currently a Senior Fellow in the ESRC-funded UK and a Changing Europe initiative, focusing on Brexit's impact on Northern Ireland and the Irish border. David Kenny is Associate Professor of Law at Trinity College Dublin and an expert on Irish and comparative constitutional law. And Etain Tanham is Associate Professor of International Peace Studies, also at Trinity College Dublin. She's an expert on cross-border cooperation on the island of Ireland and on British-Irish intergovernmental and diplomatic cooperation. Katie, David and Etain, welcome to UCL Uncovering Politics. And let's start by going back to the origins of the working group. When you first heard about this project and you were invited to take part in it, what made you think this is an important issue? I want to get involved in this project. Katie, do you want to kick us off?
It's an important issue. If you're living in Northern Ireland or indeed on the island of Ireland, you can't get away from that point. Because, of course, the Good Friday Belfast Agreement, as you say, had written into it the possibility of a referendum. And that's a really crucial element of the Good Friday Agreement. But it's also one of the elements of the GFA that is least spelled out. And I think as an academic, I'm particularly keen to be able to bring evidence and thought and reading and research to any public policy important issue. And this was a really good opportunity to do that in a rigorous way and also in an interdisciplinary way. And this is why it was a real privilege to be involved in this working group, which, as you mentioned, comes at a really crucial time in British-Irish relations and indeed for the island of Ireland.
Etain, how would you answer that question?
I think what attracted me was the interdisciplinary approach. And also, I remember when I first met you, Alan, in Dublin, asking you about objectivity and was it neutral? And that really impressed me because it was a project based in UCL. Your area was not Northern Ireland of expertise. And I think that was a key thing that really attracted me because, as Katie said, it's a crucial issue and it's very understandable why some or many unionists would not want to engage with it. But it is being talked about by sections of the community in both parts of the island. So the fact that you were bringing to it an objective, rigorous methodology and perspective, and that the team comprised people with very different views, very different backgrounds and different disciplines really attracted me because it's so crucial to have rigorous research really on the topic.
You're also reminding me of those happy days when it was possible for me to hop over to Dublin and meet up with someone in a coffee shop and have a nice long chat. It
seems a long time ago.
May those times soon return. David, what would you say?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, my answer is similar to Katie and Etain's, but perhaps the slightly different focus. I feel coming from being interested in Irish constitutional law, but also very much in Northern Ireland's constitutional status and future, and also being interested in the process of referendums. I felt that there was a real need to take a close look at some of the issues surrounding the possibility of unification referendums as it started to be discussed seriously for the first time in the aftermath of Brexit. And there were two things that sort of struck me from that. One was that though I was interested in the legal issues, I had to stop at the water's edge because my expertise ended there. And so the prospect of bringing in people from other disciplines who had great understandings of all the other relevant elements of something as big as this referendum process was really, really appealing for me. And I think made the project so attractive. And secondly, having been somewhat of an obsessive observer of Brexit, it struck me, as I think it struck many people that we talked to throughout the group, that one of the biggest risks of referendum process in North and South of Ireland was that it was done in the dark, that we didn't really know what the referendum would really be asking, that we didn't know what the outcome would be. And I think some of the uncertainties around Brexit in terms of the relationship with the EU, in terms of Northern Ireland status, which played out in the aftermath of that vote, were very much in the forefront of my mind. And I thought this opportunity to really discuss the process questions around this referendum, to try and deal not with the question of the desirability of unification or the outcome of a referendum, but with those procedural questions of how it would take place, what the question would look like, what other work would need to be done. That seemed to be an amazing project and really timely.
Because that's a really important point about this, isn't it? That we haven't done this project because we think that a referendum on this question is imminent. So as several of you have mentioned, there is provision in the Belfast Good Friday Agreement for a referendum on the unification question. And a referendum must take place if it appears likely that a majority in Northern Ireland would vote in favour of unification. So, you know, it is the case that it's possible that we could find ourselves in a situation where a referendum has to happen, but we don't think we're there yet. There's evidence from the opinion polls, from election results and so on, and none of it points to the idea that criterion is already met. But I guess, you know, who knows where opinion might move over the coming years. Things are quite uncertain at the moment, partly as a result of Brexit. The coronavirus has been another huge kind of jolt to political systems all around the world. So there's a great deal of uncertainty. But working out these kinds of complex process issues when it isn't imminent is actually in some ways the best way to do it. And could I ask you what particular perspectives you felt that each of you brought to the group? Maybe David, continuing with you. So you're an Irish constitutional lawyer, you have particular expertise in referendum law. What were the issues that you thought the group particularly needed to address?
Yeah, so obviously for the lawyers in the group, we were very keen, as I think everyone in the group was also keen, to make sure that the core legal requirements for any referendum would be met, and to stress the importance of the legal framework that surrounded these potential referendums. And obviously, one of the crucial elements of that is the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. And this is a sort of a crucial element of sort of constitutionalism on the island of Ireland. It's woven into the constitution down here in the Republic of Ireland, and obviously is a foundational constitutional document of Northern Ireland as well. And it sort of sets some really important legal requirements for the referendums that we wanted to make sure would be adhered to. And so always keeping legality as a touchstone and making sure that we were keeping an eye on compliance with the agreement. That's something that I think myself and the other lawyers on the group were keen to add. The other thing for me was, as you mentioned, I'm very interested in referendums generally and with referendum conduct rules. And so one thing I was really interested to do in the project was to look very, very closely at the referendum rules that would govern referendums in Northern Ireland and down here in the South, and to compare them and to contrast them and to look in the ways in which they might be lacking or could be improved. And so being able to come with that background of having examined referendum rules in practice and seen some of the deficiencies, to try and bring that knowledge to our consideration of how we could improve referendum rules in advance of any vote like this.
Etain, your expertise lies in North-South cooperation on the island of Ireland, British-Irish relations, those kinds of issues. What were the main issues and questions for you?
I think, like David, Brexit formed a framework, a general framework, for my thoughts on the issue. But academically, my area has been focused on institutionalisation of British-Irish relations and the need for formalised relations, as under Strand 3 of the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. So my main concerns and issues were around how British-Irish relations would be conducted. And for me, I suppose academically, I wanted to, I suppose, ensure that emphasis was placed on the need for formalised relations, or at least that that be discussed as a question mark, rather than a general statement that British-Irish cooperation is necessary, that that would be pinned down more precisely. And the reason for that is partly it's Strand 3 of the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. It is their provision for that through the British-Irish Intergovernmental Conference. But also in my academic research, going back to my PhD, when I looked at cross-border cooperation, my findings were that the organic, spontaneous levels of cooperation were not very successful, that very taut British-Irish intergovernmental leadership and organisation seemed to be a necessary condition for effective cooperation at all levels. So I suppose my deeper academic framework really rests on that, on those findings. Where Brexit comes in is that there's been such a decrease in trust, which we can see. So cooperation can't be taken for granted between the governments anymore. And I suppose that's what I wish to contribute to the project, to emphasise the necessity of pinning it down and at least raising the question of formalisation versus informal cooperation in managing key questions.
And Katie, David and Etain have both mentioned Brexit there. And of course, you're probably best known for your work on Brexit and its impact in Northern Ireland. But you're also a political sociologist with deep understanding of the various communities in Northern Ireland. What were the questions that you particularly wanted the group to address?
I think I was coming with the hope of getting some answers to be able to answer the questions that are often posed to me, particularly in relation to international media in response to Brexit. And there's, of course, been a lot of interest in Northern Ireland as a result of Brexit and the border. And oftentimes people would be asking, well, you know, can't all this be resolved with a border poll? And I bring often to that question evidence from opinion polling and surveys, the Northern Ireland Life and Times survey in particular. But I think one thing that's very clear, and particularly with your expertise, is people think of referendums as offering an answer and therefore bringing a solution to a problem. And of course, it's much, much more complicated than that, particularly given the fact that these things aren't just an event, it's a process involving a huge amount of very important layers of preparation, but also decisions. And so I think in relation to those questions we were asking in the working group about, well, what decisions do have to be made? You know, what is not clear at this particular point? And then in relation to that decision making, what evidence should be drawn upon? I was really looking forward to the working group beginning to tackle those things. And I have to say, I mean, you talk about the fact that referendum isn't imminent at the moment. So that in this way, there's a safe distance between a referendum happening, but there's also a distance of being an academic as well, not to be rarefied in any position, but also just that particular unique status that we have as academics that does bring a distance. And therefore, when it comes to matters that are not just complicated, but highly, highly sensitive, really good to be able to bring good quality research. And I have to say the experience of being in the working group beyond anything else has probably been one of deliberation and detailed discussion. And it's a very long report, but it's been a fraction of the amount that we discussed and disagreed about. All of that process is really important, I think, in beginning to be able to then answer the questions, well, wouldn't it be solved with a border poll, to be able to begin to answer that in a sort of much more informed way.
Yes, I think we can all sympathise with those comments about the process. And let's talk about that process a little bit. So as Katie said there, partly it involved a lot of deliberation among ourselves, exchanging ideas, sharing our expertise on different topics. And, you know, there's four of us here, but there were 12 of us in total with all sorts of different kinds of expertise and perspective on these issues. And we looked at draft papers, discussed draft papers in exhaustive detail in these meetings. But we also tried to hear from as many people outside the working group as possible. So we received dozens of written evidence submissions. We had dozens more oral evidence sessions with former Taoiseach, former prime ministers of Ireland, other senior politicians from Belfast, from Dublin, from London, former civil servants, journalists, academics, community organisers, all sorts of different kinds of people. We held a public consultation last summer where we got well over 1,300 responses from a very diverse array of different people. And we also published an interim version of our report last November, and we held public seminars and got media attention to that in order to, again, try to drum up some discussion around some of the interim conclusions that we were beginning to draw. Could I ask all of you, through all of that, what would you say that you've heard or you've learnt that you found most striking? Etienne, would you like to go first on this one?
I think just as David was talking about the limits of law or what you learnt from working in an interdisciplinary team, I think I really learned a very significant amount from the law academics in the team about the possibilities and limitations of politics and the interpretation of various terms. External impediment was one that was discussed at length, but there were many others, and it made me far more precise in how I thought about politics, about British-Irish relations, specifically in terms of the British-Irish relationship, looking at who does what and who has the authority legally to do what. And apart from that, we all had different perspectives, you know, political scientists as well. We had very different approaches, and that came through our discussions, our arguments, our consensus. It was a very intellectually demanding, rigorous experience.
Katie, what would you say? Any particular surprises?
So there are two things. One that really struck me, and I won't lose sight of this, and that's the responses to the public consultation, and just quite how many people, the majority of people, saying about concerns for stability and most particularly the risk of violence if this is handled poorly. And that included people who want to see a referendum, want to see Irish unification. And as somebody coming from a long time ago, peace studies background, I think it's worth keeping that at the forefront of our minds. Not to say, of course, not to discuss these things, but just to be aware quite how significant these matters are, and the fears around it as well as the hopes. More in a more mundane way, but also very significant. I didn't expect to see quite how significant the discrepancies are between the rules in relation to campaign conduct and financing are between the UK and Ireland. And this, again, your expertise was really invaluable here, Alan, just bringing this to the forefront and realizing how many decisions need to be made, indeed how much legal changes need to be made a long time in advance of any referendum being on the cards in order to address these issues, which could be potentially problematic.
Mm. And David, your expertise on referendum conduct was vital for that. What were the points that were striking or surprising for you?
I found two things really stood out to me when thinking about this. The first was that, as Atain has said, the meetings of the group were so fantastic in terms of the quality of the discussion, but also in raising issues that I just didn't think about or didn't fully appreciate. And again, I think that's disciplinary limitation, something that doesn't have direct legal effect, I can often safely ignore, but is a vital part of sort of a political agreement and a constitutional agreement more broadly. And I think in many of the group's meetings, we were debating fine points of meaning of things like the Belfast Good Friday Agreement that I had read so many times but hadn't stopped to think about this particular part. And hearing those discussions and those debates and forming views on foot of them was really, I think, remarkable as an academic experience and I think obviously essential to the group's work as well. The second thing that stood out for me was the evidence that we heard. Like Katie, I found the public consultation to be fascinating and hugely important. And the meetings we had with individuals as well, the evidence that we took from people who in various ways had devoted their time or mental or physical energy to questions related to this topic. And some things were quite common to that group. Many, many people spoke about sort of a fear of a Brexit style referendum, a referendum that was ill thought through, having bad consequences. And it was interesting to me how many people had had that thought and how the experience of watching Brexit had made people concerned about referendums that were perhaps somewhat vague or somewhat underspecified. But also the fact that much as I think we were experiencing in our various ways, that there was so much more to this topic than we'd appreciated, even if we'd looked at it carefully. Seeing some of those witnesses, again, who had extraordinary experience, practical experience in this, thinking things through as we spoke to them, and perhaps in a couple of cases, maybe changing their minds as a point was put to them or something they hadn't considered was kind of thought through. Seeing that live as sort of a, you know, an active learning process, and how everyone in the process, no matter how experienced academically or practically, had more to learn and more to understand and more to think about, I think showed me both the immense complexity of the topic we were dealing with, but also the importance of the project.
Yeah, we were talking with people who were many of the people who had thought most about these issues, who had been in the room in 1998 negotiating the terms of the Belfast Good Friday Agreement, who had been involved in making that agreement work subsequently, who had been thinking, you know, some of them would very much like this referendum to happen and have been campaigning for a referendum to happen indeed. But often they didn't have answers to the sorts of questions that we were exploring. And that, yeah, as you say, really brought home the importance of this work. Okay, so let's move on then to some of the group's analysis and conclusions. We can't possibly cover them all. As I think it was Katie mentioned, it's quite a long report. And listeners who are keenly interested in these matters will be able to look at the full report. But let's highlight just some key points. David, we've already marked you down as our lawyer for today. And we started off in the group by working out the legal framework regarding referendums on this issue as set out in the Belfast Good Friday Agreement and elsewhere. Could you quickly outline some of the main features of that legal framework?
We spent a lot of time working out the meaning of the core provisions of the Belfast Good Friday Agreement when it comes to these unification referendums. And the agreement is sort of clear on some points, but other points really required some careful thought. It says that unification of North and South should only take place by consent of the people of Ireland, North and South, freely and concurrently given. And some of the things that we had to work out would include questions like concurrence. Does concurrent mean precisely simultaneous? So the referendums have to be happening day and date on the very same day, North and South. Other questions that we had to look at were slightly more problematic or contested in terms of us trying to work out what we thought about them. Etain mentioned that the Good Friday Agreement says that this process should take place without external impediment. What that sort of impediment might be, what that would mean in practice was something that we had to debate very carefully. But ultimately, we concluded that this process does require a referendum, both north and south, that it has to be a majoritarian process, that despite perhaps what some people might wish, the only way under the agreement that these referendums can be conducted is by simple majority, that 50% of votes plus one on the day that they are held is enough for the proposal to unify to carry. But those referendums have to happen at north and south, and that if they happen, the majority of people voting in favour is enough for unification then to take place. Nothing else is required. The big questions then that we had to answer on top of that were calling the referendums and when might these referendums actually be sort of triggered, as it were. And again, there is some clarity in the agreement on that, that it's the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland that has the decision on whether or not to call a referendum of this sort. First of all, a discretionary power where the Secretary of State can call a referendum for whatever reason, once it hasn't been called within a preceding 7-year period. But then a mandatory obligation for the Secretary of State to call a referendum if it seems likely that a majority of people in Northern Ireland would vote in favour of unification. And then the questions, of course, that we had to ask were, when is that? What sort of evidence should the Secretary of State look at in shaping their judgment on that crucial question? And we concluded there were lots of potential sources that would be relevant, such as opinion polling over a period of time, votes in the Northern Ireland Assembly, etc. Lots of potential ways that that could be done, but no absolutely sort of strict rule about how it would take place. And also something that was very important was, if that's the process for triggering these votes, that the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland makes the decision, what, if any, role is there for the Dublin government? Because, of course, a referendum would have to happen in the south, which will be in the control of the Dublin government. But under the agreement, they have no formal role in making that decision. And we concluded that that was legally the position, but that it would be politically very desirable for there to be some cooperation. So really, we found that there was a lot in the agreement that was spelt out, but other parts that, even though suggestions were made, lots of careful thought and interpretation was needed to expand upon what that would mean for these referendums in practice, should they ever come about.
Yes. And Katie, let's pick up that point that David mentioned there. The Secretary of State must call a referendum if it appears likely to him or her that a majority would vote for unification. And as David said, it's not clear from the agreement how that is to be judged. Can you sum up what the working group said on that issue?
Yes. So essentially, we were looking at various ways in which the Secretary of State could assess as to whether there'd be likely to be a majority in favour of unification. And this, you can use different types of evidence, of course, as David mentioned. So the one is to sort of look at what opinion polling might be. But immediately then you have other questions around different types of opinion polling that takes place. You could also consider qualitative evidence as well. Or else you could have different forms of demonstrating a majority in favour of unification. This could be maybe a vote in the Northern Ireland Assembly, which would be quite a powerful indication of that. But also, you'd also have the question of first preference votes in elections, or indeed seats won. Another element, which is often in consideration when people think about, of course, the possibility of a referendum of this nature, and this is demographic data. So the next census in Northern Ireland is likely to see a majority Catholic population in Northern Ireland. Is this something that the Secretary of State should consider? So all these things in the mix, and in the working group, we debated and discussed them in great detail. As I say, looking in a little bit more care at the different types of considerations here. Ultimately, we decided that it wasn't for us to put a weight on various forms of evidence, but it is important that we do know before the Secretary of State makes that decision, the grounds upon which he or she will be making that decision. And this relates to some of the wider principles that we maintained throughout our work in the working group that we think would be, that are considered necessary to be consistent with the principles of the Good Friday Belfast Agreement itself.
Yeah. So one of those is the general principle that the government must be impartial and rigorously impartial, to use the language of the agreement itself, in approaching these issues. And one of the hardest issues facing our group concerned how a referendum process would be configured, if you like. In particular, would you hold referendums on the principle of unification and then afterwards, if votes favoured unification, work out the details? Or would you develop a plan for a united Ireland first and then hold referendums? Could you say a bit, Katie, about what criteria the group applied in seeking to think through these options and what conclusions the group reached on that?
So it got quite complicated quite quickly, thinking several dozen possibilities of referendum configurations. Because, of course, as I mentioned earlier on, it's not just a matter of it being an event. It is a process involving the planning in advance, the design of the referendum itself, and then what happens afterwards, including the transfer of sovereignty. So in whittling down the many possible configurations to what we ended up with, which is three that we sort of recommend to be considered most seriously, there were five main principles that we drew upon. One is a procedural legitimacy. This isn't just in terms of the legal side itself, so the process respecting the principle of legality, but also publicly people should be able to accept the results as fair. And this in some ways also relates to the necessity of this being a planning in advance, or at least people being aware of how decisions are being made in this matter. Another principle is stability. And again, it's not just short-term stability about the process not generating destabilizing effects. As I mentioned before, public consultations show people are concerned about that. It's also the long-term stability of the outcome. Three other criteria. One is clarity, so the process is as clear as possible. And again, we ended up recognizing it to be extremely complex, and clarity is important. I think the working group report tries to set it out as simply as possible to show people what these referendum configurations might look like. Informed choice, people need to know what they're voting on, having full and reliable information. And again, the difference between UK and Ireland in referendum information campaigns is something that should be noted and addressed prior to any referendum. And then finally, the principle of inclusivity. So generally that process should allow for the inclusion of diverse groups across all parts of society, both north and south on the island of Ireland. Those principles are ones that we all stand over, but of course putting them then into practice when you're talking about such a complicated matter and a sensitive matter, that was something else. And in all the recommendations from this working group, we've tried to be consistent in applying these criteria, recognizing where in some cases it's going to be very difficult to maintain full compliance with all of these at all the time.
And I guess in particular, we found there was a tension at the very least between the principle of informed choice, which implies that you want to work out as much as possible before a referendum about what a united Ireland would actually look like. And on the other hand, the principle of inclusivity around the design of a united Ireland. So if you want the form of a united Ireland to be inclusive, then you want all communities to be taking part in that, in the process of designing it. But unionists in particular, people who want to maintain the union, the existing United Kingdom, are presumably not going to take part in designing united Ireland before a referendum when they're still campaigning to maintain the union. So if you want to have an inclusive design, then it kind of seems like you have to do that after a referendum vote for unification rather than before it. And that tension was a really difficult one that the group had to grapple with. And, you know, ultimately, there is no way of getting around it, really. There are unavoidable trade-offs to be made there. Etienne, we're talking there about the process of working out a plan for a united Ireland. What would that actually mean in practice? What issues would need to be addressed? And what processes could be used for coming up with solutions?
I think you and Katie and David have touched on a lot of the issues. You know, ultimately, it's the governments, either one of them or both of them, that decides many of these issues. And they are very fractious. And obviously, with maximum inclusivity and consent as far as possible, But even that very decision and that very choice, which we've touched upon, is sensitive, and trying to get the balance right between informed choice and inclusivity is the core dilemma. So it's the governments that have to negotiate these issues, navigate them really, and negotiate them, taking on board as much opinion as possible. There are then specific decisions about timing, about concurrence, about wording, where it should be the same, about the rules of the game being fair and seem to be fair and, you know, on both sides. So all of that necessitates cooperation and coordination. And there is the issue which came up quite often in our discussions and with witnesses about the possibility, if it happened, that in the Republic of Ireland the vote was against unification and in Northern Ireland that it was in favour, what would happen then? So there are issues there very much about timing and about information sharing between both governments about what is the situation in Ireland in terms of public opinion, because that would be a very destabilising situation. And what are the defaults, which is in our configurations? You know, what's the scenario if that happens? So these are crucial decisions, and it would be impossible to make them without the governments coordinating closely. Another big issue, of course, is the terms of transfer of sovereignty. You know, what would be the subvention?
And you've set out there the issues that we focused on to do with the process of decision making about the future of Northern Ireland, and then processes of unification, if that is what voters choose to go for. There's a whole further set of issues, of course, regarding the form that a united Ireland would take itself in terms of the constitutional structures, the arrangements for healthcare and education and justice systems, and all sorts of further matters that would need to be resolved. Many of those being essentially matters for the Irish government to come up with proposals for, nevertheless seeking to draw in as many different voices in decision making on that as possible. Well, thank you so much, Katie Hayward, David Kenny and Etienne Tanham. It's been fantastic to work with all three of you and all the other members of the working group over the past 18 months, and really great to hear your reflections on the process today as well. So thank you so much. The full report of the Working Group on Unification Referendums on the Island of Ireland is available from the project's webpage, which is part of the website of the UCL Constitution Unit. And you'll also find there an executive summary, a blog post by me, a video outlining some key points, and lots more information. We'll link the page in the show notes for this episode. Next week here on UCL Uncovering Politics, we're looking at the political theory of education policy. What rights do parents have to decide how their children are educated? What are the implications for elite private schools and for faith-based schools? We'll explore these and other questions with UCL's very own Professor Adam Swift. Remember to make sure you don't miss out on that or other future episodes of UCL Uncovering Politics. All you need to do is subscribe. You can do so on Apple, Spotify, or whatever podcast provider you use. I'm Alan Rennick. Our producer is Abby Turner. Our theme music is written and performed by John Mann. This has been UCL Uncovering Politics. Thank you for listening.